Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Kevin Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sheriff Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the British.
Yep.
Yes, you're indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And we're really looking forward to having a chat with you again. The listenership has been fantastic, so thanks for tuning in. Today we're going to be catching up with a legend, and that word is overused, but not in this case. A legend from the rugby sport in the Western Australia, and that is from the Western Force, and that is Matt Hodgson. But anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And as usual, we're going to have two topics to discuss. And John, first up, I'm going to actually go with the Western Force and obviously the news that they've been thrown out of Super Rugby. Now, there's a couple of things I want to talk to you. Obviously, there are the issues that have been raised about the ARU board saying their financial constraints and that the reason that they're doing it and even the way they've gone about it. But I just want to look at it and say, could WA have done more to help the Western Force, to help sports necessarily in this state? Now, if we look at it, Twiggy Forrest, there are some people saying, why didn't he come in earlier? Had he come a bit earlier, would that have made a difference? The one thing I want to look at, though, is we've got all the media outlets in this town jumping up and down going, oh, this is terrible, this is awful. But where's their support been over the last 10 years? And you know, we set up this show because there were sports that do not get coverage, or they have to fight for any coverage on the commercial TV stations, in the newspapers, and even on some of the radio stations here in Western Australia. Now, if you look at the West Australian, when the Force started, it was all bells and whistles because they got all the membership. So the West thought, wow, there's an audience out here. So they did the lift out, the Super Rugby lift out.
I think, remember the famous photo at Subiaco Oval where one of the supporters got them all there, and they made a big deal about it then.
Yeah, absolutely. And then suddenly, you know, when they moved, or those fans walked away when Peter O'Mara broke the promise of leaving Subiaco Oval after two seasons. And that upset a lot of fans. And, of course, hot on the heels of that came his deal with his mate Tim Johnston with Firepower, which again caused, to me, that was the most damaging period for the Force. I think it has recovered in the last 2 years and is back on the rise, as their results on the pitch showed this year. But again, if we look at it, the ABC then covered it on the radio. They covered the Force games, but they only covered the games against Australian teams. Then you had 6PR in their first seasons. Again, they were on board the first season, and we did it. I did it for Sport FM. Russell Dower got me on board to do that, and he was the man driving that. Now, here's an example. When we were doing that, we wanted to interview players in the pre-match broadcast. We were told, if you want to talk to any of them, you've got to pay them. That was from the CEO at the time. And we're going, we're trying to promote the thing here. So this is where, again, I don't think Peter O'Mara was necessarily the right man at the right time. I'm sure he's a very good CEO in certain other businesses, but I don't think he was the best thing for the Western Force. But if we look at that again, 6PR would then, if there was a footy game, footy took priority over the Super Rugby. So I question whether the media has really got behind it. I'll also tell you a story where I spoke to a person who took a redundancy from the West Australian, worked in their sports department, and he told me that the Glory and the Western Force will never get the column centimetres or column inches, if you, depending on how old you are, that the AFL gets, for the simple fact that they are seen as a threat because they have the capability of getting crowds of 30,000 plus if they're going well, whereas the West will willingly give West Coast Fever, Wildcats coverage because they will never get those crowds because they have stadia where they play and never going to have those capabilities. So again, there is, to me, I think the media has actually held back the team when it could have actually supported, could have helped it along the way if it wasn't so insular in the way we promote a lot of the sports and the sporting teams in Western Australia. But look, there's a lot of things I think still to play out with the Western Force. I find it really sad because, as I wrote on the website, notthefootyshow.com, I worry now that this is going to give some other sports the courage to say, you know what, if we've got to cut costs, let's cut Western Australia out of the equation. Now, just finally, before I wrap up my piece here, I've been told that one of the heads of SANZAAR was saying, had Australia or the ARU come back and said, look, can we make it Super 16s? and keep the fifth team because we're facing this legal challenge. It's going to cost us a lot of money. They're saying that Sanzar would have probably given it the seal of approval. They would have gone to 16 and would have accepted the five teams in Australia. Now, that's what I've heard. I haven't had it confirmed, but you just wonder, have the ARU asked that question? And if they haven't, why not?
That's a good question. Couple of things. I mean, in the case of our local daily newspaper, I mean, there's not too many column inches left given over to news in that anyway these days. So, you know, I think sports have got to look beyond the old paradigm of daily newspapers. And they are. A lot of sports are. People no longer take their news anymore. I don't read it. I don't buy it. I know a lot of people that don't. I'm sure the only people that still buy it are cafes and my parents. So the dynamic is changing, and yes, that may have been the case in the past with sports in WA, but in the future, it's going to be outside of the hands of those people that have been controlling it in the past, and it's already starting now. The ARU decision, I mean, they knew quite a while ago that this idea was never going to work, this expansion was never going to work.
And we said it the minute they launched it and announced it.
It's turned out now that they had advice given to them before they signed on to it that it wasn't going to work, and they went against that advice. So you've got to question the role of these people at the top of rugby in this country. And I'd like to go through the names of all of the board members, but it's probably not a good idea because they've obviously got some very good lawyers behind them. But if I had shares in any one of the companies those blokes were in charge of, I'd be getting rid of those shares quick smart, because they've proved through the running of rugby that they don't really have much of a clue at it or at all, and are unable and unprepared to follow advice from people that do know.
But the thing as well, John, that is amazing about this to me is the fact that they have now made a decision. And if you look at South African rugby and you look at the Australian Rugby Union, who've done the same thing, they've made a decision to dump two of their teams in South Africa, one in Australia, but still keep Japan and Argentina within that. And let's be honest, South Africa, New Zealand and Australia are the power brokers within Sanzar. And you can't tell me that the money that they're getting from those two markets is compensating losing Australian and South African teams. At least South African rugby, though, has found another competition for their teams to play.
And I'm sure that they're going to look even more closely towards an alignment with Europe in the future. A couple of points. First up, what role has the IRB had in this? I mean, the IRB would have been pushing very, very hard to get Japan and Argentina into the Super Rugby competition. Now, I have no doubt the smarter people within the Sanzar movement would have said, come on, look at the figures, you know, we're struggling here, we're struggling there, let's be serious about that. And we'd have to drop some teams, and I get the feeling that they knew before they allowed these teams to come in that they were going to have to drop teams.
You may be right.
And that the IRB are behind the push saying, these teams go in, you guys have to sort it out, but these two guys are going into your competition.
Look, I know there was pressure, certainly from the IRB for those two teams, especially with Japan hosting the next World Cup.
And they had to let Argentina in, because they couldn't just throw Japan in there.
Yeah, and Argentina on their world ranking and the fact that they play now in the rugby championship, it seemed a logical thing. But if you look at it, let's take Japan out. If you think the more logical thing would have been to have given one of the island nations the other berth, because then if you say you're going from Perth, the Western Force could have gone South Africa, Argentina, dropped off then in one of the islands on the way back and had a round the bottom of the world ticket, played a game, say, in Sydney and come back to Perth, or played a game in New Zealand and come back to Perth. I mean, I know it's a long trip, but it's still a long trip at the moment going all the way to Argentina and South Africa.
I wonder how the players from South Africa and New Zealand are going to feel when they suddenly figure out that they're not going to be stopping off in Perth for a few days to play a game in between. That flight is now a 12-hour flight, not a 6-hour flight.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's going to be really disappointing. I mean, we touched on before we came on air, there's talks of all these protests against the ARU with the test match coming up against the Springboks. People have said that the Aussie supporters should wear green and support the Springboks. There's been talk that there should be a mass boycott. You and I talked about this, I'm saying, but the thing is the ARU's got the money because the tickets have already been bought. But you can give your argument on that in a sec. The other talk that's going around, which to me There's two things I think should happen if you want to make the protest. Is one is everyone, instead of wearing green and gold, goes wearing the colours of the Western Force. I think that would actually send a pretty strong message. And even if Springbok supporters did the same, imagine if there was a stadium that was decked out in blue when the Wallabies are playing the Springboks. That would send a really clear message internationally, because those games are taken internationally. The second thing would be to do what the A-League fans did, is to turn up to the game and then walk out during it. Because again, suddenly if the stands just empty, say 15 minutes into a game, and those games, as I say, are being broadcast worldwide, that too would send a message to the rugby community outside of Australia and all around the world that people here are not happy with the decision.
And I don't think it'll make one iota of difference what you do. Turn around, wear a different colour shirt, do any of that, but it's not going to make any difference to the ARU. The only thing the ARU understands is dollars. And they've proved that patently by basing this decision wholly and solely on financial constraints. There was nothing, they said nothing else about the reasons.
But they should reveal those financial constraints. That's the big thing. It's all right saying that. That's a great word or phrase to bandy around. Yeah. But show us the numbers. Give us the numbers so we can actually see that you've made a measured decision.
I agree. Now, my preferred method of protest would be not to turn up to the test match, to let them play it in an empty stadium, and to take that financial windfall for the ARU away from them. Because apparently it's not, rugby's not viable for financial considerations. So why are you playing a test here? Now obviously that's not going to work, because rugby, you know, I understand why rugby people would want to go. South Africans would want to go. I get that. I would like to see it be that way, that nobody turn up, but it's not going to happen. So you've got to find other forms of protest if you feel like you have to get it out of yourself. But it's not going to make any difference. What I would like to see is no one turn up to that particular test, and every rugby person who was going to go to that test instead take their whatever $80 or $70 or how much of a ticket it was going to cost you, go down to your rugby club, your local rugby club, and spend that money over the bar at your local rugby club instead, and give the money to WA rugby, not to these clowns from the eastern states.
I think you're being generous with the price of tickets. I think they're about 100 and something.
Oh, that's even more of a reason.
Really, I agree with you. That's a good idea. Give $120 to junior rugby.
Absolutely. Go and spend a Saturday afternoon or down at your local rugby club and have a few beers over the bar and enjoy yourself and put the money back into the game where it deserves to go, not to St. Leonard's.
Well, yes, that music, if you listen to the show regularly, means we're going to turn our attention to rugby union, and we are going to catch up with the man who is the captain of the Western Force in their most successful season. He's now hung up the boots after a fairy tale win over the Waratahs, and we are, of course, talking about Matt Hodgson. Matt Hodgson, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Hi, guys. How are you going?
Well, you've retired now. I mean, how's the body feeling? Is it really sort of sore, or I believe you've got some operations lined up?
Yeah, it's actually not too bad. I've had a month off training, so getting it recovering that way, but I'm keeping myself busy. Sort of back into training this week, and yeah, a few surgeries to get done in the new year.
Do you want to just give us a short rundown of what's in line?
Yeah, so I actually did my AC in the first minute of the last game, so it's dropped about 18 mil. So I need to get that re-screwed and reattached, and then knee clean outs, ankle clean outs. So pretty much any joint needs a clean out.
Just looking back on that last game, it was a dream come true to score a try and then obviously to convert the penalty for the final score as the siren had gone. No one could have written a script like that.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. We joked during the week that it'd be funny to finish off with a match-winning kick or a kick in the game. So for that to happen is pretty incredible. And I said to a lot of people it was good because the last 20 minutes we got to enjoy it as a team and actually be part of the moment. Often when you play sport, you don't actually be part of the moment until the end of it. So actually to enjoy it and do it together as a team for that last 20, it was really enjoyable.
You started off as a fly half, didn't you, in your younger days, so the kick was never a worry?
Yeah, it was a worry when he brought out three tees for me and I didn't know what a tee was. I wanted the sand. So, that was pretty funny. But Ian Pryor and Jono were right next to me, so I had some good guidance there. And Ian's still claiming it because I stole his tee. So we're going to put a signature on that and sell a few of them.
That's a good idea. I mean, looking back on your career, I mean, you started out in the Central Coast playing rugby. Did you ever have the dreams of achieving what you've achieved?
I think growing up, you make one rep team or something, and then you actually think about it and you go to watch a Wallabies game or a Super Rugby game and you go, I'd love to do that one day. But for it to actually happen, it's something that dreams are made of. And the way my career sort of panned out, had a few hard things happen when I first started and a hard false start at the Waratahs the first couple of years. But to come over here and actually enjoy playing rugby for a further 12, 13 years and getting over 100 caps is something pretty special, and I think it's now that I've stopped playing that I'm actually really enjoying those moments, and just seeing how incredible a career I did have, and what I did learn and what I did get up to during that time.
You've always struck me as someone, though, who's very focused. Like, if you set yourself a goal, you're going to achieve that goal. Is that how it was when you sort of got the Wallaby call-up? It was, you'd always said you were going to do it, and you did it?
It's more when people say I can't do something. I like to prove people wrong. Growing up in a small town, often it was said you'd never make a Sydney team or a rep team. Proved them wrong there. And then not going through the private school system when I was growing up, they often said you would never play schoolboys or play representative age groups. So actually going through club system and actually getting to represent Australia at under 21s back then was something pretty enjoyable, and that sort of made me want to make a career out of it. And again, people often said I'm too small or didn't have the skill set to play Super Rugby, so it was all about proving them wrong. And then again, having coaches saying that you'd never make it or be able to play for your state or for the country, it was all about me trying to prove them wrong and actually prove that someone from the Central Coast can actually make it to the top of their sport.
Sounds like there was a lot of negativity around at the beginning.
I think that you always come up against criticism. Even still, people critique how you do things in day-to-day life. So my advice, I do a lot with juniors, and that is to have that mental toughness and stay at it, because often people that get an easy run or an easy opportunity in their young age, they don't go on with it because they don't know what the hard times are like. So I enjoyed going through the tough times, and that made me a better person and a better player.
Do you think that's where your leadership came from? Like, were you a leader as a child, or do you think through those setbacks and that determination to prove everyone wrong, that's where the leadership came?
I was quiet when I grew up. Even when I first moved to the force, I was pretty shy and sheepish. And even in the first stages, you sort of have those doubts and you don't know if you belonged in that sort of group. But I had some great people around me at the Western Force. The likes of Sharpie were pretty inspirational in the way he led the team. And then through experiences you have along the way, often coaches or captains don't go through hard times or injuries or get setbacks. So I was lucky enough to go through them, so I could explain how I got through them to players and actually show that there are different avenues to go through.
Just listening to you talk there, it seems as if the Western Force coming along came at just the right time for your career.
Yeah, it was perfect. I was fortunate enough to take up the last spot at the Western Force, as many people know. If I didn't get that opportunity, I probably would have gone overseas or just retired from professional sport, full stop. So it gave me that added incentive to try something, go out of my comfort zone again and move across the country and go to the unknown. So it was pretty exciting, and that's something I never look back on now.
One thing I think you need a pat on the back is West Australians are not very welcoming in terms of making Eastern States guys their heroes. Adam Gilchrist is one, but it really appears that they've taken you to heart.
Yeah, I think, I'm not going to lie, it was pretty hard in the first couple of years moving over here, not knowing anyone, and also moving with a lot of people from the East Coast. We sort of didn't see ourselves as Western Australians straight away, but as I got to know more people and actually bought into and got to learn a lot more about Western Australia, I hopefully can call myself a Western Australian now, because I love it over here. And I think once you embody that and actually take it on as your home state, I think people are welcoming. I think you see that with the Force this year, doing a lot of stuff in the community, and the players actually feel like they're representing not only Western Force, but they're representing Western Australian.
And that's the sad thing now, isn't it, that it may be no more. I mean, you spoke up vocally, you know, as captain to defend the keeping of the license. Do you think we've still got a chance of keeping it?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously devastated news on Friday when it all came through, but the amount of work that has gone on, not only in the last couple of days, but throughout the whole year, proving people wrong again, on and off the field, what we're doing is great. Second in the Australian Conference, the same wins as the Brumbies, playing probably the best style of football in Australian rugby, and having the most local talent, bar Queensland and New South Wales, representing their state is something pretty special. The amount of juniors that are now taking up the sport, it's the fast and growing sport in WA, so that sort of stuff drives you on, and definitely I think the fight's still there. You see everyone fighting in the last couple of days, people jumping on board, and it's not only people that support the Western Force, it's people that support rugby, people that support sport, so it's pretty exciting, and that gives you an added incentive or more drive to actually go on and fight the good cause.
Yeah, it's been very hard to take, I must admit, and it just seems a crazy decision, because after a bit of a roller coaster time at the Force, because obviously there was a bit of a dip with the firepower issues, it felt as if the club was finally moving in the right direction.
Yeah, it's often, we talk about on the field, about getting momentum, and I think the club off the field has that now. Obviously had some tough times, but every new club sort of goes through this. You look at Fremantle and West Coast, how long they took to get established, even teams in the NRL. It actually takes time to put your roots in the ground and actually grow something, and that's what we're doing now. We've actually grown it. We feel comfortable in Western Australia, getting those local produce through and getting the balance right, and the community support has been something that's really jumped on board, and we've had diehard fans from day one, but now those sometimes fans are turning into fans that are turning up every week.
There has been talk that Sanzar, if the ARU had pitched it to them to go to Super 16, they may well have not cut an Australian team. Have you heard that rumor?
I try not to read the media at the moment, but I think we as Rupa, a player's representative, I sit on that board, we actually presented to them a 16 competition, and it got knocked on the head pretty quickly. It comes down to all this financial talk, but again, the criteria is unclear to us, how the decision's been made, and that's the answers we're still seeking, which is the frustrating thing. I think everyone would have been disappointed or frustrated if the Force got axed, but with the right reasons or due diligence, but the way it's gone about and the way it's been portrayed, one, the time, but also how and moving the criteria, we seem to be ticking the right boxes, and then they change the criteria, especially now they focus on the financial standing, but we've got a guy backing us and saying the Force will never be in debt again. So that's the complicated thing and the most frustrating thing that the players, the club, the staff, the fans are all frustrated and angry about.
Absolutely, and it's great you're still fighting for it, even though you have hung up your boots, because also you're pretty busy now because you're opening a gym.
Yeah, it's important for me to fight. I know I got the opportunity to play for the Western Force, but it's all the kids. I've got a four-year-old that plays local club football, and I want to give him a pathway. I want to give all those players that are playing from under sixes all the way through to 16, 18s to want to represent their state, and that's a good reason to stay in the fight and be vocal about it because of the amount of support we got. And yeah. Definitely staying busy, that's for sure. Sleepless nights about these decisions, so I'm glad that I've got things going on with the new gym and stuff like that. But, yeah, definitely pushing hard to fight and get the right outcome for the right reasons.
It's interesting you talking about your son, because Hans Sawyer was on the radio on the East Coast this week, and he was saying that, you know, obviously the values that rugby instills, do you feel again that that is one of the unique things about the game? There is that honour, there is that integrity, etc.
Yeah, definitely. You see, everything goes into rugby. I think now it's probably the only sport in the world that gives everyone an opportunity to play, all body types, all nationalities, and it's a global game. If we can't even represent all of Australia, how can it be a national game and therefore hence a global game? So if you're cutting off half Australia, there goes the national side of it. So there's many reasons to fight, but I think about the juniors. I remember when I first came over here at the Western Force doing development camps and stuff, teaching under sixes all the way up to under 18s, and now seeing those players represent the Force. I often speak all throughout the year is those Richard Harwicks, Dane Halliperties. When I first came over, they were in those camps and we were teaching them skills and drills. And Richard's probably a good example. Would he have ever played Super Rugby or for the Wallabies if the Force weren't around?
No, absolutely. Now, just quickly, because you have got your gym, it's due to open very soon, F45 in Subiaco. A new direction, or is it something you've always had in the back of your mind?
No, it's something I've been doing probably for the last 3 years. The pathway out of rugby is something I've been thinking about, and this type of training that I do here is very much based on what I did as a professional athlete and getting me fit for rugby seasons. And the best thing about it, it suits everyone, and it's in right now. Time poor people, convenience, and we run 7 days a week. So it's the type of training I do, and it got me through rugby. So yeah, looking forward to getting as many people in as possible.
But it's not just training for elite athletes, is it? It's for guys who just want to play local rugby, local football, any sport, or just stay fit.
Yeah, it's for everyone. At my other gym at West Leaderville, we've got people from 16 all the way up to 70 years old doing it. Everyone trains at their own intensity, and the trainers that I hand pick actually get to know you personally and actually go on the journey with you and see improvements pretty quickly.
Well, Matt, great catching up with you. Thanks for the memories as a Force brand. Let's hope you're still involved and there is still a Western Force.
No, definitely. And hopefully everyone can get down to UWA on Sunday for the rally. It's pretty exciting getting a lot of people down there to show the support and also for the players and staff to say thank you for the backing we've had.
Thanks very much.
No worries. Cheers. Thanks, mate.
Hi, this is Ian Healy and you're listening to This Is Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to the podcast of Not The Footy Show. We hope you're enjoying the show and we hope you enjoyed that interview with Matt Hodgson. I think we've talked enough about rugby on this show and we should probably just turn our attention and to another topic now. John, it's your turn to throw one up for us.
Oh, how about concussion? Let's go with concussion because we've seen recently a report come out of the United States, a study of the brains of ex-NFL players, and of the 111 brains that were studied, 110 of them showed signs of traumatic brain trauma, the kind that leads you to an early demise or serious mental health injuries. Now, obviously, American football is a unique case because of the way the game is played, and the repetitive nature of the head injuries that these players are suffering. And let's be frank here, it's not concussions involving one big smack in the head where you have the lights put out and they carry you off on a stretcher. We're talking about hundreds of micro concussions. Every time they put that helmet on and have a hit up in a scrimmage, a practice scrimmage, every time they play a game and they crack their head against another helmet, that's what's causing these problems, which makes it a unique problem for the NFL. However, concussion occurs in life, just naturally. Nothing will, you know, playing sport, not playing sport doesn't protect you from concussion. You can get concussion at any time. But what, as sport, how do we approach this problem for concussion? Is it a problem for sport generally, or is it only a problem for specific sports? Now take the case of rugby union. Another recent study came out to say that rugby union players are X percentage more susceptible to enlarged heart diseases than any other sports person. And the reason for this was because they spent so much time on the ground, physically involved with the game, that their hearts were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because as we know, the heart is a muscle, and they will grow. So it's not just concussion that is an area where particular sports can lead to particular health issues later on in life. How far do we take this discussion with concussion? Are we going to see the end of the NFL in America?
Look, I mean, this debate, I think, has been going on probably for at least 10 years now, and there was a brilliant documentary. I was trying to remember when you were talking what it was called about exactly that, the concussions within NFL in America. It is a way. I think rugby union have really, excuse the pun, tackled it head on, and that they've really come up with policies now. They're really strict that if you have a concussion, you can't play for a set period of time. I'd like to see a few other sports be a bit more responsible about that. I mean, you have seen footballers, soccer players getting a head clash, and they're back out there midweek playing a game, and I just wonder whether that is in the best interest. It's going to be really interesting. There was a case in Canada, John, a long time ago, and this was, we're going back a long time because this was when I was working on 6NR. So I've been to a few stations before then, since then rather. And Well, there was a case in Canada where players were being made to play while carrying injuries. So it was usually a hamstring injury, and they were being made to play either ice hockey or they were being made to play soccer in that country. And there was a player whose career was shortened because of that.
And like his hamstrings?
Yeah, because he was playing, and he basically lost by expert opinion about 3 years of his career because he had to retire early because his hamstrings were shot. Because the coach kept going, mate, I need you to play, I need you to play. And he sued the club in the end, and it was under the law in loco parenti. So it was the coach was basically taking the role of a parent in guiding that player. Now, when you look at the amount of money a lot of these players are being paid, how often is the club putting pressure on that player to get out there to play? Because, again, we have to look at the trends of the modern world in sport, that a lot of fans no longer go to watch their team. They go to watch a player, the superstars. And that is a fact. It upsets me that that is the case. There are still old guys like me that go and watch the team rather than a specific player. But I think where the money is there and where the team or the coach are pushing a player out there, I think you are going to see players or the families of players who are afflicted down the track may well turn around and say, hang on a sec, you were sending him out there when he wasn't fit.
Yeah, there's that, and there's the other side of it too, and that's the player wanting to go out there and being told by a doctor that, you know, this is a chance this will happen. There's a great scene in the American football movie Any Given Sunday where the player's begging the doctor to be given a painkilling injection so he can get back out on the field. Come on, doc, just give us a bit. And so that pressure comes from players as well. It's not just clubs that are forcing these guys to do it. And a lot of these guys are on contracts where you get more money if you play. You don't get as much money if you're on an injury list. And there's a little bit of personal greed involved here in that side of it.
Oh, look, I can tell you, even myself, I broke a rib playing in a semi-final of a rugby tournament, and the final was a week later. And the doctor actually said, you know, I don't suggest you play. It was a lower rib, so he was going, your lung, if you get hit on there again, you run the risk of puncturing your lung. And my father was a doctor. I'm going, well, what do you reckon, Dad? Do you reckon I can play? And he goes, I don't think it's really going to make any difference what I say. He goes, I know you and you're going to play. And I did play in the final, but I must admit I was very wary of playing that because it was in the back of my mind that if I do get hit on that side, I'm in a bit of trouble. But again, it's exactly like you say, you want to play. It's a final. I wanted to play.
Absolutely.
There was no way I was going to miss that game. If I could run, I was like, I'm okay to play.
You know? Now, you mentioned before about, you know, players suing clubs, etc. And you were essentially talking at the top level of sport. But what I think we need to do is look at the lower levels of sport, because a lot of teams don't have a doctor on the sideline. A lot of teams don't have neurologists who are able to come in. You know, everyday grassroots sports people, they're the ones I'm aiming this discussion at. Of course, if you're in a professional team, you're going to have doctors there that can recognise concussion. If you're a sports medical expert in this day and age, and you don't know and can't spot and identify concussions and how they're likely to occur and when they're likely to occur, then probably time to get out of your job, mate. That's a key component in modern professional sports for a medical person to understand.
And I think credit must be given, because often I, in particular, knock administrators, but I think credit to the likes of Rugby WA and Football West, who now have said you need a medically trained person, certainly in their top competitions. Now, obviously, when it gets down to the amateur level, trying to get a fully trained medical person or physio to be at those games is a little bit harder to make happen.
That's right, and that's why I think sports have got to start looking at being able to place protocols and procedures so that people who aren't medical experts can at least have some idea of what they should be looking out for. Now, I had a concussion playing hockey earlier this year. Now, my concussion didn't come about because I got hit in the head by a ball or a stick. It was actually, I just fell over. And it was quite an innocuous incident, and no one noticed. It wasn't until after the game, when I was asking people what the score was, and we'd got flogged 6-0, that people suddenly realised something was up. But it still wasn't enough for anybody to take ownership of that situation, because you can't expect the person who's concussed to have any idea or be able to treat themselves and make rational decisions. But there was no one who perhaps either felt they had the position within the club or or that they had the authority to say, hang on, no, you're not going anywhere. You're going to sit down here. We'll drive you home. That's at the level I think sport needs to do a little bit more about getting it down to those amateur club levels. That watch out for this. Don't allow it to happen, because that injury is not likely to cause me some long-term neurological damage. It's a very simple concussion, and it's had no long-term effects.
Are you sure?
Well, but where it could have an effect is when you're driving home and you miss the red light or you go through the stop sign.
No, I think you're right, John. I think, you know, if you look in the workplace, you have people with first aid certificates now. There should be maybe a proviso brought in that sporting clubs have to have people that have attended a course where they can see those telltale signs or can make an assessment at least on behalf of the players within the club.
A poster on the wall of your club with some signs, you know, just the same way they do with eat healthy fruit and veg. You know, it's not that far removed from just doing exactly that. Just making people aware. You don't necessarily have to run thousands and thousands of dollars worth of programs and all that sort of stuff. You just need to get people aware and thinking about it so that when it does happen, oh yeah, oh, we've got that poster up there.
But I can agree with you, because I've had delayed concussion twice, once playing sport, and it was later in that evening. I remember I was sitting there and a picture, just the two people in the picture merged into one, and I went, whoa, this is trouble, and spent the night in hospital overnight. The other time was when I got mugged and I got home and went to bed, and then the next day I had to play cricket, and I remember I felt pretty okay. And then I ran into bowl, and I bowled one ball, and then my run-up just went to pieces. I went back, tried again, then just collapsed on the pitch and was violently sick, and again had to go to hospital there. So it is sometimes you don't know and you feel okay, and it can be something that can cause it down the track. So maybe those signs were there, maybe they weren't there, who knows. But no, I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, and I think when you walk off the field not knowing the score and asking teammates what ground you're at, it's probably a good idea to just settle down, have a nice cup of tea, and let someone drive you home.
Yeah, but you have been renowned to go, where am I?
Occasionally. It was quite funny, because I felt fine. In this case, I didn't have a headache. I've had concussions previously, and once I had a concussion, I couldn't walk for 3 days because it hurt. So I had some sort of idea, maybe that was too much of an idea about concussion, didn't realise myself that you can get these little micro concussions. I got home, I was fine, my partner asked me how the day went and how did the game go, and about 2 minutes into me telling her what had gone on, she looked at me and said, "You really are stuffed in the head, aren't you?" So it can happen and you not even realise.
Hi, I'm Thomas of Hitman Hunt, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
If ever there was a sport where you're going to get concussion, that's one. Thomas the Hitman Hearns and boxing, obviously.
Yeah, I wonder with all of this stuff that's coming out, though, whether boxing's going to review the use of helmets.
Well, they're calling it pugilista dementia now, aren't they?
It's got a name.
Yeah. Anyway, just before we wrap up, I wrote a piece a while ago on the website, notthefootyshow.com, just saying how I get frustrated now that the modern-day CEO will not do interviews, a lot of them. They don't do one-on-one interviews. They will only have a press conference, which is, anyone who's attended press conferences will know that nowadays the media manager protects them from any hard questions and calls a halt to proceedings if those hard questions are asked. But if you do actually apply for one, they ask for the questions in advance. Now, that, again, annoys me, because you think, when I was 10, if I'd have been given the questions in advance, I would have passed all my exams. The whole idea of an interview is not necessarily that we want all the answers being basically prepared before you come on air. So it's a little bit frustrating. Now, I contacted the FIH, the International Hockey Federation, for an interview with their CEO over a month ago now. I was asked to send them the questions, which I duly did. We're told that because the Hockey World League semi-finals were on in South Africa, that we would have to just wait. So we've been waiting for them to come back. Haven't come back to me, so I email the communications manager on holiday. So then he was due back on Monday, so I sent him an email saying, "Hope you had a good holiday. Where are we with this interview?" Get an out-of-office message that he's out of the office, and he won't be replying to his emails till the end of this week. If I want to, I can contact him via WhatsApp. Now, I'm sorry, but if you're the communications manager, communication is the key part of your role. I don't think you should be away from email contact if you're the communications manager.
I agree. In fact, I wouldn't hold out any hope of getting any email soon from the FIH, actually. As you know, we Matt Allen and myself run the reverse stick.
Which I'm enjoying immensely, I must say.
Oh, thank you very much. And we've tried contacting the FIH. The first few episodes, I was sending them an email every week saying, oh, we've got, this is our episode and we're talking to this person and we'd like to talk to the FIH. We didn't even get an email back acknowledging that we existed. Not even one back saying, oh, good on you guys. Nice to see someone doing something for hockey. I mean, the FIH didn't get off their ass and do anything. They don't run a podcast. They just put out stupid press releases in the worst marketing language you could possibly ever read. And they won't even acknowledge that someone's out there trying to do something good for the sport. So good luck with your endeavours.
We'll keep you posted.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It's in foul.
See ya. We'll be back next week.